This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal land. This Friday, the US president secures a diplomatic victory with Pacific leaders. And hoop dreams, the Opals taking on China tonight in the Basketball World Cup semi-final. Superstar Lauren Jackson is back in the green and gold.
Here she is again, all those years later. She's 41, several knee operations later, but she's there to drive the belief in all of the others that they can do it without her.
First up today, National Cabinet has decided to scrap mandatory COVID isolation rules 2 weeks from now. The Prime Minister has stepped out of the meeting with state and territory leaders to announce the change, along with an end to pandemic leave disaster payments. But the nation's top medical officer warns that this doesn't mean that the danger of COVID-19 has passed. Our reporter David Sparks joins me now. David, what has National Cabinet decided? Take us through.
Well, Sally, this marks the end of one of the last key pandemic restrictions. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says it is a unanimous decision by all the states and territory leaders and himself. And he says that's very important because he's keen to keep a nationally consistent approach to dealing with this pandemic. Some state and territory premiers and leaders have been pushing hard for this, of course. And what the change means is that the mandatory isolation requirements, which force people to isolate for 5 days if they test positive to the virus, that will come to an end on the 14th of October. Also ending on that date will be the pandemic leave disaster payments. Now, the states are going to decide for themselves how to implement this change. But one thing that's important to note is that the change will not apply to people working in high-risk settings. So in settings like aged care, healthcare, disability care and a few others, the isolation requirement will remain in place, Sally.
And David, what's the nation's chief medical officer saying about this decision?
Well, Paul Kelly is warning that people shouldn't suddenly become complacent because of this. There is still the risk of COVID all around us. But he is saying that this change to scrap the mandatory isolation is very much a decision about the here and now. He says it's made in the context of case numbers and hospitalisation numbers as they stand right now. He didn't make the decision himself, of course. He provides the advice to the Prime Minister and National Cabinet, but he's explained the thinking behind the advice.
It recognises that we are in a very low transmission, community transmission phase of the pandemic here in Australia. It does not in any way suggest that the pandemic is finished. We will almost certainly see future peaks of the virus into the future, as we have seen earlier in this year. However, at the moment, we have very low rates of both cases, hospitalisations, intensive care admissions, aged care outbreaks, and various other measures that we've been following very closely in our weekly open report.
So that's the Chief Medical Officer, Paul Kelly. And Sally, he's also pointed out today that at the moment, the community actually has very high, what he calls hybrid immunity, as a result of previous infection and also as a result of high vaccination rates, particularly in the really vulnerable communities like older people in aged care settings and people living with disability. So it is a good news situation, as Paul Kelly is pointing out, but not yet time to celebrate the end of the pandemic. He's certainly pointing that out.
Good on you, David. That's our reporter, David Sparks, there. The United States has won a diplomatic victory, convincing Pacific leaders attending a high-level summit in Washington to endorse a joint declaration. The statement was backed by all of the leaders, including the Solomon Islands Prime Minister, who signalled just a few days ago that he wouldn't sign. Political reporter Stephen Jedgetts joined me a short time ago. Stephen, good afternoon. What is the declaration and why did Solomon Islands change its mind?
Look, the declaration is basically a broad statement of principle that the US hopes will be its guiding North Star for its attempts to try and really ramp up and intensify its engagement across the region, whether that means more posts. They've announced three new diplomatic posts, whether that means trying to boost more trade between US firms in the Pacific, whether it means scaling up aid programs, which is another thing that they've promised to do. This statement is meant to be essentially a guiding principle model for them. Now, it is interesting that all Pacific leaders have signed up. As we reported earlier this week, Solomon Islands officials sent a diplomatic note to their fellow Pacific officials earlier this week saying that PM Manase Sokovare wasn't going to be in a position to sign up this week because they needed more time to consider it. They needed to push it through their national parliament. And that note also stressed that there simply wasn't consensus on many of the elements. But for whatever reason, Mr. Sokovare seems to have changed his mind or has been convinced otherwise, because his name does appear at the bottom of this statement. So it will be interesting to dig into over coming days and weeks what the US might have offered or said to induce him to do that.
And Stephen, what are the most significant elements in this new US strategy for the Pacific, and what do you think it means for the region?
Well, I think what it means for the region is that it confirms that the entire US system is now determined to do what it can to try and reassert American influence. And in the short term, in particular, that will mean increasing attention and increasing resources. There's some US $800 million in new spending here, although 600 of that, it has to be said, was already announced by the US vice president earlier in this year. It comes in a form of financial assistance for the management of fisheries. Still, it's not an inconsiderable amount of money, even though it's sprinkled very widely over a number of different programs. That will bring benefits to the Pacific. But then, of course, there are also risks to this as well. In particular, as competition intensifies, the behavior of all states becomes a little bit more unpredictable, including China. How will China respond to that? So this creates both opportunities for the Pacific, which they're navigating pretty deftly, but it also brings challenges as well.
That's our political reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, there. Americans are being told to brace for a worsening death toll as the destruction left by Hurricane Ian in Florida becomes clearer. The US president says it could be the deadliest hurricane in the state's history. Now the Carolinas are in the path of danger. A short while ago, Ian had been downgraded to a tropical storm, only to pick up force and become a hurricane again. Sarah Sedgie reports.
It's the state that's most affected by hurricanes in the US, but no one was prepared for the ferocity of Ian. Rescue crews on boats try and reach people stranded and get them to safety. They know too well from experience that even though the storm has passed, people are still in danger from floodwaters and fallen power lines.
This could be the deadliest hurricane in Florida's history. The numbers are still unclear, but we're hearing early reports of what may be substantial loss of life.
U.S. President Joe Biden says everything will be done to rescue people and later rebuild.
The federal government will cover 100% of the cost to clear debris and for all the costs that the state has to engage in to save lives.
Among the hardest hit areas has been Fort Myers in the southwest. Council member for Fort Myers Beach, Dan Allers, told the BBC he's worried for the many people in his community still unaccounted for.
I've had several phone calls and text messages asking to check on people that they haven't had contact with since 4 or 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Several were in lower-lying homes. Heard from people that have been stuck in lower homes that have had to cut through the sheetrock to get up into the attic. Some of those people have not been heard from since 4 or 5 yesterday afternoon.
He's shocked by how destructive the storm was.
This storm was a complete monster. We had 14-foot storm surge, as best guess I can estimate. Winds that were well over 140 miles an hour, it appeared to be, came straight onto the island, right on directly onto the beach. It took everything that was on the beach, concrete, newer building, and pretty much demolished it. Everything on the bay side of the island is pretty much demolished. There's not a whole lot left. Houses are completely gone. Streets are blocked by houses that were from other streets. It is catastrophic.
At least 700 people have now been rescued from floodwaters. The damage from the storm is being felt far and wide. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
The impacts of this storm are historic. And the damage that was done has been historic. And this is just off initial assessments. We've never seen a flood event like this. We've never seen storm surge of this magnitude. And it hit an area where there's a lot of people in a lot of those low-lying areas.
Off the coast of Fort Myers, the only bridge on Sanibel Island has been destroyed. Homes are ruined and there's extensive flooding. People are being airlifted to safety.
Well, Sanibel is destruction. For those of you who haven't been, it's a beautiful place, really neat community, and it got hit with really biblical storm surge, and it washed away roads, it washed away structures that were not new and could withstand that. There have been a number of people that have been identified and brought off the island safely, and those efforts are ongoing.
The storm has intensified again. The U.S. National Hurricane Center is warning Hurricane Ian is next putting the Carolinas and Georgia at risk, with possible life-threatening flooding, storm surge and strong winds.
Sarah Sedgie. You're listening to The World Today. The Australian Medical Association says waiting lists to see specialists in public hospitals are getting longer, with existing data masking the extent of the problem. The AMA is calling on states and territories to publicise transparent and consistent information about what it calls hidden waiting lists. In a report being released today, the AMA says some states publicise varying data, including maximum wait times, while others don't release anything similar. Annie Guest reports, and a warning, this story touches on suicide.
Enduring pain has been part of Mal Gregory's life since his 20s, after developing rheumatoid, then osteoarthritis. It forced a right hip replacement, but 2 years later, his left hip gave out.
Early February 2020, couldn't reach down, do my shoelaces up or put my socks on. Walking movement resulted in sharp pain around the hip area, radiates through to your lower back.
It affected his job as a business manager of a landscape supply company.
Impacts on how you consider yourself as a contributing employee as well.
In January, Mal Gregory was told to brace for another 18 months.
Not only having to suffer with the pain that I had, but knowing that there was potentially no end point to focus on, put a lot of strain on my relationship with my wife and my family, not being able to do social things. I just found myself lowering myself into a hole of depression and loneliness.
By mid-year, the 55-year-old felt suicidal.
I was actually very close to carrying out a potential ending of my life.
He shared his feelings with health authorities, who he says scheduled his hip replacement within weeks.
I start to feel a little bit guilty that I've finally had a positive outcome.
So positive, in fact, that in the fortnight since his operation, he walked his daughter down the aisle, albeit on crutches. Dr. Steve Robson is a gynaecologist who sees many patients wait in pain.
It's common. It gets worse while people are waiting to see a specialist. And even when they see me, they then face further waits to have surgery.
Dr. Robson is also the president of the Australian Medical Association and is today releasing a report about patients waiting to see specialists in public hospitals.
There is a hidden waiting list. And that's the time when a GP will see a patient, say, I think you might need some form of operation or other care, will refer you to a public hospital clinic, and there are long waits.
The AMA's report says New South Wales, Northern Territory and the ACT do not publish the number of patients waiting to see specialists in public hospitals, while Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia and Tasmania release varying data, such as maximum wait times or the percentage of patients seen within recommended timeframes.
The AMA wants immediate transparency on the waiting lists. We need to know how many people are waiting to see various categories of specialists, how long they've been waiting, and how urgent the problems are. And we think there's going to have to be some hybrid of increasing capacity in hospitals and outsourcing. There's very few other things you can actually do.
The AMA's report says patients are waiting over 700 days for orthopaedic and eye appointments in Victoria and Queensland, and 930 days for a neurosurgical appointment in Victoria.
That's Annie Guest reporting. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The 1,700-kilometre-long inland rail line from Melbourne to Brisbane is shaping up to be one of Australia's biggest infrastructure projects. Thousands of jobs and millions of dollars are already boosting regional economies along the way. But there are lingering concerns not only about the route itself, but the project's ever-increasing cost, as Nathan Morris reports.
We're making sure that Australia exists away from Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne.
When it comes to the Inland Rail Project, former Nationals leader and one-time Infrastructure Minister Barnaby Joyce has been one of its biggest champions. It was through the coalition agreement he struck with Malcolm Turnbull that almost $8.5 billion was first committed to it.
Now, Mr Turnbull wanted Western Sydney Airport, well, I wanted the Inland Rail. And now we've got the money, we don't want to lose the money, we want to build it, they've started on it, let's get the thing done.
Since then, the Australian government has invested up to $14.5 billion.
We want to make sure it's delivered, not so much for the National Party or for me or for anybody else, but for the people who live along the line.
But last year, a Senate inquiry questioned the project's business case and its ever-increasing cost, claiming it could blow out to over $20 billion. That matches the observations of Cameron Simpkins, a former project director at the Australian Rail Track Corporation, or ARTC, which is the government-owned corporation that's responsible for building it.
When I arrived and we got the documentation, it was very clear that it had been done in a rush.
Rushed? It should have happened like 1950. If I followed the not rushed process, we wouldn't be building it at all.
Cameron Simpkins says when he arrived at ARTC in 2017, some of his colleagues were surprised that even secured the project.
It certainly appeared like two guys with a Commodore listening to KC in a sunshine band, you know, roaring up the road beside the railway going, yeah, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. So I think they just looked on Google Maps and went, no problems here, keep going.
At one point, he says, an independent engineer was brought in to assess the plans.
All the culverts have been stripped out to remove the cost. All the level crossings have been stripped out to remove the fencing. The kilometres and kilometres of fencing hadn't been included. None of that had been included in that initial cost.
Roughly 300 kilometres of track has been built, and all but 5 kilometres of that are upgrades to existing railway lines. The ARTC says about $2 billion has been spent so far. Catherine King is the Federal Minister for Infrastructure and Transport.
It is well over original budget and well over time. I think the previous government was trying to have us believe that it would be open and finished by 2026-27. It is clear that that is absolutely not going to be the case.
She's now finalising the terms of reference for a project review.
It will be a short, sharp review. Really what I am looking to do is get a real handle on where are all of the problems along the route and where is a pathway to actually resolve some of these problems. And, you know, we may not be able to fix everything.
The review is expected to be announced in the coming weeks.
That's Nathan Morris reporting. The recent allegations of racism levelled at coaches within the AFL have shocked many players and fans alike. They come on top of other problems at other elite sporting bodies such as Swimming Australia and Gymnastics Australia. The federal government says it's time to address the systemic issues that undermine the sports we love. It's hoping to make it easier to call out and report racism, discrimination, abuse and mistreatment in sport. Rachel Mealy reports.
Sports Minister Annika Wells says abuses of power in Australian sport happen far too often.
This is an episodic issue in sport. It's widespread, it's prevalent. And as the Federal Minister for Sport, I want to make sure that we are addressing those problems in a structured way that addresses the whole system.
To address the problems, the federal government is establishing a new sporting integrity unit to cover safety in sport. It'll encompass an expanded hotline to allow members of sporting bodies to anonymously report abuse. And it'll aim to act on reports much faster by offering immediate support for athletes.
Putting in place a safety in sport division at Sport Integrity Australia that's evidence-based, that's culturally informed and that's trauma-led, that will educate and support everyone in the sporting ecosystem about how power is used and abused in sport.
With 30 major sporting events in the calendar in the run-up to the Brisbane 2032 Olympics, Annika Wells says cleaning up sporting culture is a priority.
What we've heard recently, it's case by case, episode by episode, and it's ongoing and too prevalent. I think particularly the sexual harassment and sexual assault matters that we see in Australian sport have been too prevalent. And those are the ones that I think will be really assisted by putting in place this 1300 number where people can call anonymously for early advice about what their options are and what their support is.
Mary Wessner is a researcher in the Institute for Health and Sport at Victoria University.
I think cultural change at any level is really tricky. And the best approach we can take is really trying to understand everything as much as we possibly can. I mean, we know internationally violence in sport is a challenge that we're facing at a global level. And the first step towards addressing any challenge is acknowledging the fact that it exists. And that was the focus of our research originally. And I think this announcement today is highlighting the importance of the focus on safeguarding. And really, it's about what these next steps are, because we need funding to actually understand these practices and behaviours more if we really want to create initiatives that are, in fact, evidence-based.
That's Mary Wessner, researcher in violence and sport at Victoria University, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Finally today, the Australian women's basketball team, the Opals, are lining up against China tonight for a spot in the World Cup final. The Opals have clocked up five successive wins, with 41-year-old superstar Lauren Jackson coming out of retirement to return to the green and gold. The USA and Canada will face off in the other semi-final before the grand final in Sydney tomorrow night. So can Australia go all the way to claim the World Cup for the first time since 2006? Tracy Holmes is presenter of ABC's The Ticket.
Australia's winning. They've come off a sort of shattering experience at the Tokyo Olympic Games. There was all sorts of drama around one of the team's superstars, Liz Cambage. She makes headlines wherever she goes. Some of them she enjoys, some of them she doesn't. And she basically pulled out of the Opals team at the start of the Olympic campaign, and that they were devastated because so much of the game was built around Liz. But now it's rebuilding from that. And every game, they are getting better.
How important are these two words to the team, Lauren Jackson?
You can't really have a basketball discussion in Australia without saying Lauren Jackson in some term. And so if you look back, the only time an Australian team, men or women, has won the World Cup was in 2006. Lauren Jackson was in the team. And here she is again, all those years later. She's 41, several knee operations later, gone away, had a couple of kids, the whole thing. What she brings is a belief, a strength in knowledge, an absolute will to win, and that infects everybody else. And so her just being there, whether it's on the court, where she's still sensational, by the way, or sitting on the bench, she's bringing a strength and a unity and a cohesion, and it's worked because of Lauren Jackson. But Lauren will tell you she's not the most important person. The rest, everybody else will tell you she is, but she's there to drive the belief in all of the others that they can do it without her.
Can they beat China tonight?
Well, they can, but of course China's going out there to beat Australia, aren't they? And we know there's it's not just sporting headlines, it's not just basketball, it's the whole geopolitical thing. These days, whenever you have two teams competing in any sport where one is either Australia or the USA and the other one is China, there's a whole lot of other baggage that comes with that. China is very strong in basketball. Their women were probably strongest. They're not at their peak now, but they're rebuilding. Basketball is hugely popular in China for both men and women. So it'll be a very tough encounter. But, you know, hometown crowd, we'll see.
How is basketball going at the moment in attracting and keeping players? As a tall woman myself, how are they going against AFLW and against netball and other sports at the moment?
I had a chat with someone who's very heavily involved in the professional leagues here, men and women. His concern was that women's sport, he thinks generally, if you take out AFLW and NRLW, the rest of women's sport is standing on a cliff edge. And his belief in that is that all of these other sports work very hard at the grassroots level in developing talent. And then these two competitions that have massive media coverage, lots of dollars, big broadcast deals, money to invest in paying for professionals, are just going to scoop the cream off the top. And that is a concern for many sports. And so what the model looks like going forward, I'm not sure, but there are a lot of concerns for basketball, which is hugely popular at a youth level, but then they get lost somewhere along the line because of the professionalism and the swamping of media coverage from a couple of football codes.
That's Tracy Holmes there, presenter of The Ticket on ABC. And that's all from the World Today team for this week. Thanks for being with us. The program's supervising producer is Michael Edwards. Today's program has been produced by Gavin Coote. Associate producer is Barney Porter, and technical production from Nick Dan, Anna John and David Sargent. We'll be back again at the same time on Monday. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been a tough year for our economy, but spare a thought for the people of Britain, where the new government's mini-budget this week sent an already struggling economy into freefall. Today, business editor Ian Verinder on why our own budget next month will be one of the most conservative yet. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.